This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Beard Coast, the All Trudeau Beard Podcast Hour, where we will spend the next 1 hour of your life talking about the most important beard in the nation. I'm sorry, Scott. This is Politico's
BC. Just nothing else important's happened this week at all for us to focus on.
Today is January 9th, 2020. This is episode 171.
I'm Scott Delundeboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, protests ignite a proposed LNG pipeline, not literally, but the tensions between Iran and the U.S. are, I guess, a little more flammable. And are terrifying everyone. It's going to be an uplifting show. First, though, let's thank those who help make the show possible. We're up to 83 contributors this month, $257 per month. Thanks to the four people who joined us in the past week, Devin, Karen, Brad, and Lauren. You're awesome. If you want to be awesome like them and help us get to over $300 per month, go to patreon.com/politicoast. Or if you can't afford that or are already giving us money, go and tell people about us on Facebook and Twitter, Instagram. We're on all of those things.
And as a bonus, we're reconfiguring how we do the patron Slack, and we're actually merging our Slack with the Canby Report Slack because that was a lot more active and had quite a good BC federal politics channel going on already. So we're kind of bringing those together so you get a much more interesting experience on our Slacks.
It's very active. If you are a big fan of people who follow Vancouver City Council live, that's the place to be.
Or if you just want to talk about provincial or federal politics, which, let's face it, is probably why you're listening to this right now.
Another good source for provincial politics is BC Today, our longtime partner. It's BC's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free 2-week trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, you know to enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. And there's a new website. You can go to politicstoday.news to see their brand new website. It links to Queen's Park Today, Alberta Today, and BC Today. And if you go to politicstoday.news/free-trial, you can enter that offer code and sign up. Well, let's jump into segment one, All Eyes on the LNG Prize. The protests between the hereditary Wet'suwet'en chiefs against the proposed Coast Gas Link pipeline are heating up. There's...
We talked about this almost exactly a year ago.
Yeah, and it's almost for the exact same reasons. So a year ago, there was an interim injunction granted to tell the hereditary chiefs to get out of the way and the pipeline could then be built. Just over the holidays, the BC Supreme Court issued its full injunction, its interlocutory injunction, telling them you can't block roads or work as it's ongoing. And now the hereditary chiefs are launching a All Eyes on the Wet'suwet'en protest, both in their traditional territories as well as in cities across Canada, I believe. Actions here in Vancouver, Victoria, there have been sit-ins, takeovers of offices, things like that, the usual kind of protest stuff. And it all basically comes down to the question of, does Coastal GasLink have the right to build this pipeline through these traditional territories? Coastal GasLink takes the position that they made agreements with the 20 elected bound councils that their pipeline crosses, and the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs say, well, we represent the traditional territories and we are the traditional government as opposed to the Indian Act appointed one. You need to deal with us. But by you, they mean the government, because the hereditary chiefs have thus far refused to negotiate at all with Coastal GasLink. So it's a mess.
Yeah, that's one way to describe it for sure.
Added into this, I think there's a lot of environmentalists who are very eager to see BC not go down the LNG pipeline, literally or figuratively, because it's hard. It gets a bit hard to square our carbon targets and carbon goals with a continued expansion of liquefied natural gas. The BC government is claiming they can do it, but I can sense this. I get the cynicism and the skepticism of that claim. So some people like Suzanne Anton in her article on the injunction are quick to point out, oh, the hereditary chiefs have received a donation from the Tides Foundation. Haha, in a very Jason Kenney conspiratorial kind of way.
The BC Liberals really need to drop that thread because it does not do them any good. They just make them look a little unhinged.
So I guess the challenge for the BC government is they're pro-LNG. The BC NDP have been, the BC Liberals before them were, the BC Greens aren't, but they're kind of a non-factor in this in the end. They're also big on UNDRIP and recognizing rights and title, but it's hard for them to kind of square those circles in this situation. They like to refer to the elected councils, but as far as I can tell, those elected councils represent the nations with reserve land. The Wet'suwet'en territory is much bigger than that traditionally, and it's that land that's in question.
It's a tough situation all around, and I don't have a huge amount of great insight on this, and it's one of those things where it seems like probably the best course of action is to let this work its way through the courts and resolve those outstanding title issues that way, rather than trying to make this more of a political question.
I mean, it's inevitably a political question. The United Nations even decided to weigh in on this political question as the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination weighed in recently. They've previously called out Canada for stepping on Indigenous people, figuratively, literally, in many ways, and have called out a number of different projects in particular, but their most recent one singles out Trans Mountain Site-C and Coastal GasLink in particular for lacking sufficient support from local Indigenous nations. And in particular, they're also worried about the increasing threats of violence. I mean, this is mentioned in the Guardian coverage of some of the internal police discussion or RCMP discussions about tactics they were considering for how to enforce these injunctions, including positioning snipers and
So that came out a couple weeks back, that one, and I wasn't a huge fan of the reporting on that because it did kind of just lift small segments out of the larger context and kind of painted it in, or took the most negative light on it, where without the full context, it was really hard to understand the full picture. And like, snipers sound super bad.
Yes.
Yes, they do. But they have roles beyond just shooting stuff. There's also observation and other aspects of that role that doesn't necessarily get conveyed in the Guardian's reporting of it.
I think the most alarming phrase in there was kind of use as much force as you wish, was mentioned in one briefing discussion. And that may have been overly colorful language, but I'm a big fan of holding our police and, you know, people who get to carry weapons and have the authorization to harm other people to a very high regard. And the history of Canada's relationship between the RCMP and Indigenous people is not great.
It's not great. My main point, though, is just that the reporting on it was somewhat sensationalized. I didn't really feel like reading The Guardian on that. I got a good sense of exactly what was in the RCMP stuff, so much as what the 8 or 9 most sensational words of the RCMP's documents were.
So I guess the next week is going to be just following where the protests go, both here in BC and around the world, what next steps the protesters will be taking. I think that a lot of the court decisions, unless I'm missing one, have mostly worked themselves out, and Coast GasLink has the right to build their pipeline, and it's just a matter of them doing it without escalating a conflict. And so we're just in a tense situation. And, you know, I would have hoped we could go a different way than natural gas in this province, but we're here and here we go.
So the hereditary chiefs have already said they don't recognize the decision and that they've issued an eviction notice effectively to Coast Gas to get off the land. So I guess the next thing to do is just see how that plays out. And it will no doubt be contentious as they go forward, because I believe Coast Gas has said they're going to be proceeding per the court injunction they've gotten. They, you know, would like to talk to the hereditary chiefs, but as we mentioned earlier, that's not happening.
I mean, maybe there is a place here for the province to speak to the hereditary chiefs and try and find a way through or some negotiation or some deal. I think there probably isn't in any case, because they seem pretty set in their way of not having the pipeline cross that land in any situation. But it can't hurt. Well, I guess it could hurt the province to try and intervene, because right now they can just stay out of it.
Politically, I'm not sure they want to put themselves right in the middle of this conflict.
One person who did kind of put herself in the middle of it was Alberta's energy minister, Sonia Savage, who was responding in a press release to the United Nations report noting its concern about human rights abuses. Unsurprisingly, the United Conservative Party minister doesn't look highly on the UN. She wishes they would look at the majority of First Nations groups that support important projects such as Trans Mountain and Coast Gas Link. I mean, yes, maybe the majority do, but picking winners is a dark part of Canada's colonial history. And she also notes that the UN is an unaccountable international committee, and we should instead be paying attention to our duly elected representatives, which isn't quite getting into the, like, spooky UN conspiracy territory.
But although I think there's more salient criticisms of that particular committee in that China and Russia have members on that committee. It doesn't exactly, I think, strike the right message to have countries with horrible human rights abuses ongoing, in fact, that committee.
If you couldn't have human rights, if you had to have no human rights abuses to be on that committee, there would be no one on that committee.
Do we at least have the not actively committed a genocide against the Uyghurs level of threshold for not being able to be allowed on that committee?
It's a matter of scale, I guess. Canada, according to Missing Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls report, is still committing a genocide on Indigenous people. I get the point you're getting at, and I do sympathize with it to some extent. But at the same time, also, I'm like, they're not wrong to call us out in some cases. So should we move to the other sticky topic?
Sure. It's an all-around depressing episode this week, but we're going to move on to segment two.
I wrote the joke headline. I wrote, I ran out of jokes because I'm so sick of people making the I ran so far away kind of joke.
Okay.
That's where I was going with that.
It's not a pretty like, funny topic.
No.
Like war's kind of only funny when it's like Doctor Strangelove or something, and this one does not.
No, really. And a lot of people have died, and
I'm not sure joking headline on that one's really the way we want to go with it. But moving on to Iran. So last week, as we were sitting down to record, is when the news broke that Iranian Major General Qassem Soleimani.
I believe that's how it's been pronounced on the other
media. My Farsi is not good, so.
Fair enough.
Bear with us. If anyone does know how to pronounce it, please let us know. Was killed by a U.S. drone strike in Iraq on last Thursday.
That was worrying. Twitter did not take that well. There was a lot of World War III concerns, which I'm just going to do my very tiny quick aside. This isn't World War III. Is the assumption here that China and Russia would get dragged in some way? Because otherwise I just see it as like Gulf War II or III,
well,
depending how you
count. So like 50% of the world wars have started with an assassination. So it's not inherently unreasonable, although it is certainly quite an extrapolation to make at this point.
All right. So he gets assassinated by drone in Iraq. The U.S. is very quick to take credit for this.
Which alone was rather interesting. So I suppose to present this, well, there's been a lot of talk about whether or not this was appropriate, legal, a good idea in general. I think that last one's definitely a no, but to present the best possible case for why the U.S. did what they did is the U.S. and Iran have more or less effectively been in a conflict in the region, mostly through various proxy groups in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, and that the general was part of the command and control structure for the Iranians in that conflict, and that striking at a command and control of a hostile, belligerent power is a reasonable thing to do in a conflict. Now, to do it in such a open and direct way basically means you've no longer doing this as a proxy conflict, but it is now a actual war.
Yeah, the U.S. has not had diplomatic relations with Iran since 1980. The year before that was the revolution where the Ayatollah and the theocracy was basically established. Prior to that was the Shah's regime, right?
Yes.
Which the U.S. helped topple. So Iran and the U.S. have a complicated and long history.
Well, actually, no, the U.S. didn't topple the Shah. The U.S. toppled the previous government and helped install the Shah.
Right.
Who and was then toppled by the 1979 revolution.
Correct. Okay. So here we are after decades of tensions up and down at different points to armed people, you know, people getting shot and people dying. Iran promises retaliation, as they would. It seemed like that was going to be primarily a number of bases that were hit by rockets earlier this week. There was some rumor that the commanding officers at those bases had been warned they're going to get struck.
So the Iraqi officers at the bases was what the rumor is, although I haven't actually seen that verified anywhere.
Okay. So Iran strikes a number of military bases, which seems like an escalation, but also just a retaliation.
So a couple days had passed between the killing of the general, and then on January 7th, Iran retaliates, firing approximately 15 missiles or so at a couple different targets of U.S. bases in Iraq that were manned by both U.S. personnel, Canadian personnel were also on the bases, as well as Iraqi personnel. No casualties were reported, although there was damage to the bases. And then within about an hour or two of those missile strikes being reported, there was then reports coming out of Tehran that a civilian airliner had crashed.
Yeah, this is Ukraine International Airlines Flight 752, a Boeing 737-800. I've actually flown on quite a few of those planes. WestJet flies them.
The 737s are, I think, the best-selling plane in history. So yeah, there's a lot of them out there.
It goes down on its way from Tehran
the Tehran airport to Kyiv.
And all 176 passengers and crew died. The deadliest aviation disaster ever in Iran. A large number of those passengers were Canadians because there's been a lot of migration from Tehran or from Iran to Canada. 138 of the 167 passengers were traveling to Canada on that flight, including a lot from Edmonton. So I have a lot of friends there, some connected to the University of Alberta, including two professors, I believe. A number of members of the Iranian community here in Metro Vancouver.
I believe 13 people residing in British Columbia were killed on there. A total of 63 Canadians were on the plane. And yeah, North Vancouver actually has, I believe, the largest Iranian population in Canada. And yeah, I have coworkers who travel to Iran fairly, you know, at least a couple times a year. And, you know, just luck that they weren't on the plane.
And so this plane goes down. Everyone dies, and we kind of are all left wondering for a day or so. Now we're into today. What happened? Was this just a really unfortunate accident of bad timing and everything else? And the initial hints that are coming out from the U.S.'s looks at it, and Canada has accepted this, is that, no, this was an act by the Iranian government. Possibly.
That's not entirely clear. So what was revealed today, first out of reports from within the U.S. administration, and then about noon BC time, Justin Trudeau did a press conference where he announced that Canada had intelligence information that the aircraft was shot down by an Iranian surface-to-air missile.
And that's where we are today. I don't know where we'll be when you're listening to this in whether that's tomorrow afternoon, Friday afternoon, or sometime on the weekend, or hopefully not much later than that. But things are evolving quickly, escalating quickly, and tensions have not...
I'm not even sure if escalation's the right word. So far, everyone's been trying to downplay this, or at least keep things from escalating much further.
Everyone except the President of the United States.
Even him. After the retaliatory strikes... Byron, Trump's reaction was, yeah, all is well, I think was the words he used. Basically, yeah, they didn't kill anyone. Yeah, so a few missiles, but, you know, we have the stronger military. You know, we can claim victory on this one. And then today, none of the world leaders were really ready to say that there was intentionality behind this. So far, there isn't leaders trying to escalate this. And that's probably a wise decision at this point, because we don't actually know why that missile was fired. And, you know, this happened around the time that Iran was launching their retaliatory strikes. You know, no doubt their military was on high alert, and, you know, in a conflict, it's chaotic and often a low information environment. Mistakes can happen. You know, back in, I think it was 1988, a U.S. warship shot down an Iranian jet because it had mistaken the jet that was traveling over the Strait of Hormuz to Dubai as a Iranian fighter jet. So it's not unheard of for there to be accidental shootdowns.
I mean,
doesn't make it any less tragic, but it does indicate why it's not good to jump to conclusions. And really, I actually didn't see many people rushing to conclude that it had gotten shot down. There's a good like day and a half between when the news broke and when there was really serious talk of missile strike.
I think for a lot of Canadians, they were just rocked by this and really feeling it. I do, you know, want to hope that cooler heads prevail and that kind of even a tense standoff can resume for a while until longer term solutions can come about. Maybe like a more rational president who's willing to, you know, have a good denuclearization deal with Iran that doesn't get ripped up for no obvious reason.
Yeah, that's one of my real concerns here is that the U.S. president's one of the key actors in this, and his decision's going to have a lot of influence on how things progress from here. And, well, the person in the office isn't exactly known or has really ever shown great strategic insight and forethought when making decisions. And, you know, going back to the decision that tipped this whole thing off, it's far from clear that there was any real thought or analysis put into what would be the follow-on effects. Even if you grant that there was a legitimate use of force that in that situation, it's hard to justify it on, you know, strategic grounds or thinking about what the actual outcomes trying to be achieved are and the potential consequences.
Yeah, from Iran's point of view, they have probably not much desire to engage in an all-out war with the United States. They are a smaller power.
They would lose.
Yeah.
Now, invading Iran would be a very tough proposition for the U.S.
It would make Iraq look like a cakewalk. Possibly. Yeah,
likely. The geography is much more favorable for Iraq than Iran. The center of the country is basically protected behind a couple different mountain ranges that are very hard to move large armed forces across.
And so for all the talk of like the regime in Iran's unpredictability, which, you know, I'm not a fan of, I think you can predict that they are motivated by nothing more than self-preservation. Like, as long as they can keep themselves in power, that's what they're going to try and do. And avoiding war with the U.S. is probably one of the best ways to keep themselves in power. So I can see Iran trying to walk this back and say, you know, we hit our targets. That was our retaliation.
Yeah,
I hope they come out and say there's something about this airline crash. Give a story.
Yeah, they haven't exactly been forthcoming around the crash because they must have known well ahead of today's announcement that they were the ones who shot it down. And I mean, part of that may also be internal domestic politics, where the regime is not particularly popular. And that popularity would certainly be made worse by intentionally or unintentionally killing 130 of their own citizens. Now, what does remain to be seen is whether Iran does what it's often done in the past during these sorts of conflicts and launches through their various proxy groups and allied militias further attacks that have a more plausible deniability on their part. And you know, the retaliatory missile strike was very notable for the fact that it unambiguously came from the Iranian military, whereas historically that's not been their modus operandi.
One of the other elements that's at play here is Iraq is in kind of a transition period as their government tries to, I think they're in a interim period until they have another round of elections. But the interim government there, which doesn't have a ton of authority, I guess, has asked the U.S. and all foreign militaries to please find the door. They don't have the actual authority to kick them out, but they did say quite clearly, hey, U.S. troops, please get off our soil.
Yeah, and then the U.S. accidentally sent a letter saying, yes, we'll do that. Which I don't know if we have time, but there's a lot of very questionable stuff the U.S. has done throughout this. Part of it was accidentally sending an unsigned letter that was apparently just a draft that was circulating around the Pentagon that got sent to the Iraqi government. Also, apparently, from what the New York Times has reported, the strike that killed General Soleimani, that was actually just one of the options presented to Trump, and it was not actually the one the U.S. military staff were wanting and got stuck on there basically to pad out the decision matrix and present the option they really wanted to make that look more reasonable, which is something no officer should ever do. But
you don't want to murder someone. You obviously want to do this, not murder someone. We could kill someone? So
yeah, something junior officers are taught, at least here in Canada, is never pad out with their analysis with courses of action they don't intend to seriously consider.
Especially when you're...
High-level American military officers should also not be doing that.
Especially when your chief is Donald Trump. So this raises the domestic political question of, you know, we've seen how it started to play out in Canada, which is cautious, slow to make any statements. I think the first statement Trudeau or the foreign minister made after the assassination, the drone strike, was kind of a, we call for calm on both sides, which was a real kind of weaselly.
I'm not sure weaselly is the right word. Like, it's
walking the fence.
Yeah, it didn't commit to any particular narrative or course of action on it, which when there's a lot of uncertainty and the situation is still evolving, is probably a reasonable thing to do.
I think the other thing we didn't talk about was Trump tweeting about how he wanted to attack cultural sites, which I think got walked back.
Well, they tried to walk it back, then Trump said, no, I'm really serious about this.
I want to
Although
commit
that's kind of, I'm not sure being explicitly walked back, but they've just kind of moved on from that.
We're just going to stop talking about how he wants to,
which,
like,
to be clear, is a war crime.
Yeah. And Iranian history, Persian history, is rich and deep and valuable. Like, I saw some of it on display at the British Museum because they have so much stuff from around the world, conveniently. But it's important. You know, we can't just, like... Oh. So I get the frustration. I see it on the left in Canada, where why haven't we taken a stronger stand here and there? And I get a NATO ally and that. It's frustrating for me right now, and it makes me question the value of NATO in a situation like this. That's a much bigger conversation, but...
Yeah, and so right now our troops are deployed as part of a NATO presence in Iraq.
Some of ours have moved to...
Kuwait. Yeah, they started, back on the 7th, Canadians started to move some of our forces out of Iraq to Kuwait. Yeah, how NATO goes from here with Iraq, I think it's still to be figured out. And the role in the region is something to watch for. And I think it kind of brings something that's I've been thinking about around this, is that the U.S. is really involved in the Middle East in a way that probably isn't actually in its strategic interest, but hasn't really had either the discipline or the inclination to do the pivot to Asia that it really should be doing. Because, like, historically, it might have made sense for the U.S. to be involved in the Middle East for reasons of energy security, if you're thinking as a Washington foreign policy person.
Yep.
You can see the argument there. Nowadays, North America is pretty much energy independent. It doesn't really need the resources from the Middle East for economic security.
Which is ironically also one of the reasons Alberta oil prices are so bad, is because the U.S. has enough of its own oil right now.
Yes. So there isn't a strong case for the U.S. to actually be as involved in the Middle East as it is. And it wouldn't be the worst thing for the U.S. to slowly phase out its presence significantly. Europe, on the other hand, if anything, has a stronger case for it because their energy security is much more precarious, particularly with the reliance on Russia.
Well, and I think Europe faces just a human challenge of the various conflicts leading to mass displacement of humans who are crossing borders, crossing the Mediterranean, and arriving at the European border claiming refugee status in the millions. Like, that is a tangible thing that I'm not saying they need to clean up the Middle East, but play peacekeeper at least and stop the waste of human life so that people don't feel like they need to leave their homes.
And
that's a good all around. I think everyone can hopefully get behind that.
I think so too. But that also might be part of why Western countries weren't so quick to condemn the U.S.'s action, in part because General Soleimani had a fairly active role in creating a lot of those refugees. So it's complicated.
Yeah. I mean, it's not really surprising anymore, but one of the things Trump ran on was kind of this counter to the U.S. foreign policy. He was the, let's stop playing around in the world. Let's just nationalist. Let's focus here.
Well,
he even mocked.
He did a bit of that. He also was quite hawkish when he wanted to be. It was 2016 was weird. Like, everybody read into Trump what they wanted to, including people that should know better. The Donald the Dove, Hillary the Hawk thing is retrospect. Well, at the time it was stupid. In retrospect, it is even stupider.
And so here we are. I mean, like I said, no fan of the government of Iran. No fan of the government in place in America right now. I'm also no fan of war, so hopefully it doesn't get to that.
Yeah, hopefully everything kind of reestablishes a more peaceful, if probably quite tense, equilibrium in the region. Whether or not that happens is probably going to really depend on what happens over the next couple of days and as what comes out about the downing of the Ukrainian airliner.
Well, all of this has taken the attention off the impeachment trial in the Senate.
Yeah.
Which is already a joke because they're just going to...
Well, Pelosi's still holding off sending the articles to the Senate until they can nail down the rules. But, I mean, yeah, it took focus away, but I'm not sure it helped Trump in the long run. Because if there's one thing that even a lot of Trump supporters or people who are soft Trump supporters don't like about Trump, it's how unpredictable and unreliable he is on foreign policy stuff.
Fun times. Moving on to quick takes, let's start with something that is a bit lighter and I'm going to say even more humorous. And
we've had a very dark two main segments, so it's not hard to be more humorous.
Fair enough. We've touched a little bit on the conservative leadership race already on previous episodes. I think towards the end of the year, we did a little bit of a roundup of who might be and who might not be. But now we have both some rules and we have some serious names joining the race.
And some names that aren't so serious too, but we'll get to that.
I tried to put serious in quotes or something like that.
Audio medium doesn't translate.
It's not. The rules. So the conservatives are going to pick their leader on June 27th. Which is the exact middle of the 3-day Toronto Pride celebrations. That's fine. None of them are going to march anyway.
Yeah, I wouldn't be so sure. Some of the names that have been floated have marched in Pride parades in the past. And hey, this allows the new leader to get that lingering question out of the way early. Just go from the stage to the Pride parade, make it a non-story.
To join the race, you have to have some spare cash lying in your pocket, plus know a lot of people. You need to pay a $300,000 fee. There was $100,000 in the 2017 race, and apparently that wasn't enough because of the number of people we saw in it. So hopefully this...
Yeah, this is aimed to have the number of candidates probably not go into the double digits, unlike last time.
And you will need to get 3,000 signatures from Conservative Party members, which, if you want to be leader, seems like a fair ask.
At a minimum, yeah. One should be able to pull off both of those.
But in terms of number of possible candidates, there are a number declared, according to the Wikipedia page on the Conservative leadership race already. We've talked about Brian Brulot, the HR system CEO from Ottawa.
Yeah. Earlier this week, our fellow podcasters, the Boys in Short Pants, dug into his platform on Twitter, and there's some interesting stuff. We're getting a new province in the Caribbean if he becomes prime minister.
And what's great about that is he doesn't name the Turks and Caicos. He's open to taking any Caribbean island.
I guess it's good that we're checking off like the every decade thing we do of, I wonder if the Turks and Caicos should join Canada thing that like briefly becomes a thing and then gets forgotten about for another 10 years. So we've checked it off for the 2020s already. We can move on.
Brulot's not the only CEO type to have declared. Aaron Seal, the millennial conservative, has also declared. He apparently declared on October 23rd before there was even a hint that a race was going to happen. Which is
bold. Right out of the gate early. There's initiative there. That's a positive.
I highly recommend everyone go watch the video he has on his website where one of his friends films it on a phone, I believe, because it kind of is a little bit shaky, and it's him sitting at a desk talking about how...
Not even at a desk, just like lounging in a living room chair.
And then you get to see multiple shots of his business card.
Yeah, his cannabis business, because, of course...
He also mentions on his profile that he's a former yoga instructor, so it would
be a real pivot from Andrew Scheer.
So the millennial conservative. Although Andrew Scheer was so young, he was like almost a millennial. He's like a young Gen Xer, or old.
Mid to young Gen X.
So that's Aaron Seal. We also have Clayton Nutzon, who is famous for being kicked out of the Freedom Conservative Party.
So he was too much for Derek Fildebrandt.
Yeah, something about some Islamophobic rants, which takes quite a bit to get out of the Freedom Party.
Yeah, so he's probably not getting past the Green Light Committee. Because in addition to the rules we mentioned earlier, the party does actually have to approve the candidates.
Those are the fun ones.
Also his Twitter profile has a big American flag in his banner pic, because of course he...
Is he also an American citizen like Andrew Scheer?
Maybe, but I don't think he's really figured out what country he's running to lead. It's weird.
More seriously, current Member of Parliament and past Minister Marilyn Gladue is throwing her name in the ring as the first woman. She notes on her Twitter profile that she was the first female engineer elected to Parliament.
Doesn't Lisa Raitt have an engineering degree?
But maybe Gladue was elected just like a term before or something.
No, because she's only on her second term.
Maybe she's a liar. I'm just telling you what her Twitter profile said. I've not fact-checked that. Gladue could be interesting. I still don't think she's a big name for it. There are a number of other bigger names that are in the tentative about-to-declare column, though. This week we saw Jean Charest announce that he is expecting to run. Former Quebec premier. We've talked about him before.
I don't see the case for it.
Me either.
He hasn't really been, I think, relevant in conservative circles since the Mulroney era, or kind of just the post-Mulroney era.
And he may have a slightly better connection to Quebec, but I think he may have also like burned all of those bridges as corrupt premier of the day.
Yeah, it's a long shot, and realistically, the only path for him is if he just signs up so many members.
Which also seems difficult because he's not got the energy. Maybe he does. Also in the Red Tory column is Peter MacKay, who I think many had talked about as though he wouldn't run if Jean Charest did, but people around MacKay are saying he's, quote, 100% in, which you don't usually say if you don't have the sign-off from your friend to go around saying that. And then I think the person people have been talking about the most this last week, who we didn't actually talk about, I think, was Pierre Poilievre.
I think we might have mentioned him briefly because former senior Harper campaign manager and I think deputy chief of staff, Jenny Brun, has done a lot of publicity work for him or definitely came out early saying he was a strong contender.
Yeah, there's a piece in McLean's saying Skippy for conservative leader, question mark.
That's apparently his nickname.
Apparently.
Like, I think the guy's a fairly talented politician. Apparently one-on-one isn't nearly as attack doggy as his public profile is.
You could say that about Mulcair, too. That didn't end up working for... Although, no, that's because they didn't let him himself.
Yeah, Mulcair's problem was that the attack dog disappeared as soon as he left question period.
True.
So, like, there's a case for it, but it's also really hard to see him making the pivot from the hyper-partisan attack dodge to presenting the image of a prime minister in waiting.
It depends what the Conservative Party members want. They might want someone who can just press the attack on Trudeau, and maybe he'll grow into the role of prime minister if he should win. I think Poilievre has a few advantages. I think he can speak to social conservatives. I think he's...
He has to speak to Francophones, too, which is a plus.
And he can almost... He might be able to pull the populist vibe that's out there in a more intelligent way than Trump or Johnson, even though I don't think Boris Johnson's a lightweight intellectually, but he comes off that way.
Well, Pierre Poilievre has never been one to let fats get in the way of a good partisan fight, so...
All right, fair enough. Yeah. He'll be our Boris Johnson, and we're going to be stuck with him. That's basically what the latest in the Conservative race is. Anything else you've been following?
Not really at this point. They were just waiting to see who else decides to get involved. And if whether or not any of these people actually go through all the way and get that $300,000 deposit paid.
That's the thing. I think the declarations they're making that they're in is going to churn into, well, I've reviewed my options, and it turns out millennial conservatism is not actually a thing that he can run on. So we'll see. We'll keep checking in on the Conservative race as it progresses. Should we turn to BC, though?
Sure. So there's been some more developments in how the Green Party leadership race is going to shade up. We mentioned previously that Adam Olsen's been named as interim leader, but recently they did release the rules for the leadership race. So it requires 100 party members' signature from at least 5 different districts. Bit of a lower threshold than the other race we were just talking about, but yeah.
It's a smaller party.
Smaller party in a smaller area. There's a $1,000 application fee, a $15,000 campaign fee, and a spending cap of $300,000.
So a much smaller race.
Yes.
I mean, BC has campaign finance rules that will apply to this. I mean, the federal one does as well. And they're at different scales because Canada is 10 times as many people, roughly, as British Columbia. And the Conservative Party is a bigger party proportionally than the BC Greens. As far as I can tell, no one's formally thrown their name into the ring for BC Green leadership. I think a lot of people are still mulling it over. That said, if you know someone who's considering, if you are considering running, or you know someone who's considering running, we're really interested to talking to you. I think we could do a full series on BC Green candidate interviews here on the podcast, and that could be really valuable to our listeners. So get in touch with us, podcast@politicos.ca. I did look for the federal Green Party's leadership contest details, and they are under construction in the 90s web era lingo. Stay tuned is what they say. You can sign up for details. They have not listed how they're going to run that race.
Quickly circling back to the provincial Green Party, a couple other things to note. Candidates have up until the 15th of April to put in their candidacy packages, so we'll know everyone who's running for sure in a couple months from now. Party members have up until May 31st to join to be eligible to vote. And the vote's going to happen between the 15th of June and the 26th. And it will be a one-member, one-vote system. If the results to be announced on the 27th of June.
The same day as the Conservatives.
Yeah, that's not great timing on their part. Because one party's definitely going to get a lot more attention than the others. And spoiler alert, the party with the attention is not going to be the Greens.
Pretty sure the Greens picked their date first. At least they're not overlapping with Toronto Pride because they're in BC. Oh, well. Well, let's move to a federal story for a second. Attorney General David Lametti has announced that he's reviewed some of that SNC-Lavalin discussion and has decided they're not actually going to split the role of Attorney General and Justice Minister. This followed one of the recommendations from former Deputy Prime Minister Anne McClellan's report, which the Trudeau Liberals commissioned to say, how do we make sure we don't accidentally pressure a high-ranking, you know, government official into giving a sweetheart deal to our friends, thereby breaking the law?
And their answer is, everything was more or less okay the first time.
Yeah, we just need to remind people of their roles a bit better. Mostly the AG, who seemed to understand it pretty well, actually.
I don't think that was the problem.
I mean, it's not surprising that David Lametti would basically just get the report that was given to him and say, you know what, rather than do anything controversial, I'm just going to take this report and check the boxes on it. And fine, yes, we can have an extra oath or something. That'll be fine. So I almost wanted to cut this story because it's nothing. But yeah.
We did spend half a year talking about SNC-Lavalin, so a little follow-up's not unreasonable.
News out of the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, where I am on the board of directors. We have a new executive director, and it's been announced that it'll be Harsha Walia, who many people will know from her reams of activism in the Vancouver scene. She's been involved in migrant justice, groups like No One Is Illegal, the Downtown Eastside Women's Center, really just a voice for human rights and dignity, and fairly uncompromising in a, like, badass way. So I'm excited to see where the organization goes under Harsha. The BCCLA has been in a very good spot in the last couple of years. Big credit to Josh Patterson and previously David Eby for the work they put into that organization. It's also at a very tumultuous time as the ED took another role last year. Our senior policy director, Michael Vaughn, who'd been there for quite a while and developed a lot of really smart policies, she took another role. And I think there was some other staff turnover. So two of the most senior staff turned over and others' positions have needed to be filled. That said, there's a new strategic plan. There's a lot of good stuff going on, but it'll be a rocky year that I think will come out strong. So it'll be cool to see where this goes. Good times. It's fun being on the board. I wasn't directly involved in this decision. There was a hiring committee that did the actual hard work there. I just got to hear the reports and go, well, cool.
Cool. Okay. Well, let's move on to, I think, the final serious story in this. The Bank of Canada announced they're going to be putting out a new $5 bill and are seeking public input on who to have on it.
So the current $5 bill, which I'm holding in my hand, and I hold it in my hand because I very rarely have cash, has Sir Wilfrid Laurier, the first Quebecois prime minister in Canada, on the one side, and the Canada arm on the other. I really like the Canada arm. I'm a nerd, so I hope we don't lose the Canada arm. That said, the other bill I have in my pocket is Viola Desmond with the Canadian Human Rights Museum on the back, which is also pretty cool.
It's cool, although I have to say, flipping the orientation really does annoy me slightly.
It is
weird. Which is entirely probably just the fact that I'm used to the horizontal rather than vertical orientation for the bills, but
it's like vertical video mode, but in a banknote.
Yes, but like vertical video mode, it doesn't look as good.
Exactly. So
hopefully the new bill will be horizontal in orientation, but regardless, the Bank of Canada is going to be soliciting everyone's input. So more to come from them on that. But if you have any ideas on who should be on the new $5 bill, let us know.
I just hope they don't do what they did with the scientists they put on one of the bills a couple years ago, where they tried to make a ethnically ambiguous scientist, and they did it by like blending all of the races together, and then they got this sample that they focus grouped and people were afraid of it or thought it didn't look white enough or something, and they went, all right, we'll scrap that and just do something not weird. It's one of those situations where I hate
really
everyone
such a
involved.
Weird little controversy that I don't think anyone was really looking that closely at the bill.
Yeah.
don't know. That was a weird thing.
So, yeah, suggest someone good for the $5 bill.
Some Canadian.
There's lots of choices. One option could be we could put Justin Trudeau's beard.
I thought you were going to say the royals were apparently absconding to Canada now, but...
Oh, I want to avoid that story. I want to avoid that story so hard.
So that and Iran have been like the two things that apparently everybody wants to talk about. And one of those is a serious news story and the other is weirdly becoming a big thing.
But to get back to the important story that we started this week on, Vice broke the news that Justin Trudeau grew a beard over the holidays.
And I'm not sure they even broke the news on that, but they did a whole story on what could this possibly mean. I mean, the guy's coming off like 2 weeks of vacation. It probably meant he just didn't bother shaving for a couple weeks.
But he hasn't shaved it yet because his press conference today, he still had it. And it's weirdly captivating to me. I can't turn my head away.
It's a beard. Until the whole Iran thing kind of became a really big thing involving Canadians, this was apparently the thing that occupied everybody's time, which I don't get.
I mean, maybe that's just because you can grow a beard, and when I try, it does not work well. So maybe it's just jealousy. It was noted, I think I saw a meme, that it makes Trudeau one of the first prime ministers with facial hair in like a century.
Didn't his dad have a beard at one point?
Maybe not people while he was prime minister.
People were quick to point that out. So
it's been decades then.
Yeah. Yeah. More bearded people in politics is good, I guess.
That's the kind of week it was. Started off silly, got really somber, and we can end off this show a little silly.
And that has been Politicos. Find links to everything we talked about at politicos.ca. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politicos. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Sergei Plotnikov. Politicos is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by Cortado Productions. Thanks for listening.